What is Peace Brain? Peace Brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Welcome, everyone, to the Peace Brain Show. This is your host, Dr. Gail Lash, and I'm happy to have you here today. Today, I'm excited because we have Anju Gattani with us to talk about the powerful topic of what it is to be a writer, particularly of international women's fiction and books that bridge cultures and break barriers. And as usual on the Peace Brain Show, after Anju and I are finished talking, there will be a transformative meditation at the end of the show. So please stay tuned for that. But first, I want to open the show with a quote from Lang Leave, another well-known writer, and she says, "There is one thing you should know about writing. It will inevitably lead you to terrible places, as you cannot write about something you have not lived. Though the most important thing to bear in mind is this, you are there as a tourist and must always remain one. There was a specific reason why you were blessed with the ability to translate your sentiments into words. It is to bring a voice to suffering and torment. But do not be too indulgent with your experience of these things, despite how addictive suffering can be, how easy it is to get lost down the twisted path of self-destruction. You must emerge from adversity, scathed but victorious, to tell your story and, in turn, light the way for others." I really like this quote because, to me, it emphasizes the need for personal experience by the writer. You know, you must have lived it. You must actually know what you're writing about. And I actually think that this is true because we write what we know, and we know it because we have lived it or experienced it. We each become the expert of the story and then guide the reader through the labyrinth of emotions and trials. But I also like that Lang writes that we must be a tourist and visit the torment or experience to give it a voice, but not stay there and leave that experience in favor of returning home in victory over it. We must come home again more wise, you know, like the hero of 1,000 faces coming home victorious and ready to share it with others. So today's show is about writing and international relationships. It's very appropriate we're talking about international and global cultures. And with of course, my company, Tourism for Peace, and the global look that we do with our Peace Brain work. So I'm really happy to introduce my guest, Anju Gattani, who explores these concepts and these international flavors in her best-selling novels. And let me tell you a little bit about her bio, read you her bio. It's kind of extensive and really amazing. Fiction author, international freelance journalist, blogger, and former news reporter, Anju Gattani grew up in Hong Kong under the influence of cultural tides from the East and the West. Anju has also lived and been published in India, Australia, Singapore, and the United States in a variety of genres from fiction, feature, travel, and news to cover stories, interviews, and perspective pieces. Her debut novel, Duty and Desire, A Tale of Modern India, was published in 2011. She is a member of several professional writing organizations and obviously a mentor as well to many writers, participated in numerous book events, and is a writing instructor. Her curiosity about cultures, the traditions, and printing people's values, and the effect on their lives was the beginning of her journey. Anju observes how fixed impressions, predetermined mindsets, and habit to stereotype define people's thinking patterns and behavior. with family and friends scattered across the globe, Anju questions why, despite the leaps in technology and communication, meaning is still being lost in translation, and her characters explore these concepts. She's currently at work on her third novel in the Winds of Fire series and hopes her books will one day bridge cultures and break barriers. Her website is anjugatani.com. That's AnjuGattani.com. Welcome, Anju. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a privilege to be here with all of you.
Absolutely. I'm very excited. And so I want to know, first off, I guess, what drew you to be a writer of international fiction?
Geez, that's a hard one to answer, considering that's not how I had started off at all. You know, as a writer, you don't really go in knowing what you're doing in the first place. I guess for me at least, except putting words on paper. And so I was first published when I was 7.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And that wasn't even in writing. That was a little picture I drew and submitted. And it was Hong Kong's leading English language newspaper, which is still there today, the South China Morning Post. And I saw all these other kids getting their stuff published and out there. And I thought, well, let me give it a try. And I drew a little picture, put my name on it with my age and my little membership number. And a month later, there it was.
Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah, it was, especially considering I had tried and failed so many times and I thought my drawings are horrible. Obviously, somebody liked it.
Yes. So how'd that make you feel?
You know, I was a very, very quiet girl. When it came to being with family, I was the chatterbox, the talking one, the one who was always talking, you couldn't shut up. But when it came to being in a crowd, I was always a silent one, the one who would hide behind my mom's sari, who wouldn't talk and come out forward. And so suddenly, having your work published and seeing my name in print, I just felt like I was suddenly heard by everyone all at once without having to go up front in front of, you know, a lot of people and say what I was thinking or feeling.
Wow, yeah. That's really special. And I'm sure many of us identify with that. That's an interesting way you put that, you know, because many times we're being shoved to the forefront to be that public face and that voice. And yet that feels really scary. But to do it in words or in a drawing, in art, is a totally different way to be heard, as you said. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a real experience, an awakening experience. And, you know, it began to feel really good. I continued to submit, and then I switched from, you know, little pictures to words and poems, and I continually got published. And that automatically just started sinking in, like I said, from the age, that tender age, and I continued. I didn't stop writing after that. Just exploring different avenues, so to speak.
So let me just explore this a little bit further. What, you know, if one was a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, and wanted to do similar things you just did, you know, do a drawing or write a poem, what kind of avenues are there to publish for youth these days?
Oh, gosh, it's opened up so much more. You have the internet now where you can create your own little blog site or your own website, and you can put the words up there. You know, you can do a lot of things with creating your own brochures with all these softwares you get. Create your own brochure, distribute it to families, friends. There's just so many avenues, and self-publishing is huge now. It's not the route that's obviously for me in my books, and I discovered that along the way, but it is for many other writers, and some of them have been very, very successful. Mm-hmm. So the more avenues we have, you know, for writers, the more opportunities have opened up. And for every writer, it's a question of finding what's right for you. What's the right fit for the kind of work that you're doing and the audience or the target that you're looking at?
How do you know it's the right fit?
It feels. It's like a sixth sense.
Okay.
So I would say, yeah, there's like a sixth or possibly even a seventh sense, another dimension, which will just kind of tell you, yeah, this is the right way to go about it. And I discovered that from, you know, trial and error myself.
So tell us a little bit about that trial and error.
I was a freelance journalist for about 10 years, and I was published in, you know, publications like you read in the bio in Hong Kong, Singapore, India, the US. And all those efforts of getting an article, putting it together, interviewing people, and each audience in each country is different. So what I learned from that experience and being multi-published at the same time was you have to cater to a different audience with different countries. Your writing style doesn't have to change necessarily, but your approach to the article, your perspective on the piece, and how you put it together does have to change because you're trying to get the reader's attention. It's a competitive market no matter where you go. And so being able to spin off from one huge chunk of research for an article, I was able to spin off three different articles for three different magazines in three different countries. And that was a huge learning right there that I was able to tactfully change my writing style and the content of the material to suit each of the readers. But, you know, that was after, I would say, a good 8 or 9 years of writing that I was able to get to that level.
So can we explore that a little bit more? So, for example, you did a massive body of research on a particular topic, and then you went for a particular article for a particular country and readers. How did you know, or is it back to that quote that we started with, because you lived and experienced it, how did you know what the readers from that particular culture were looking for and how to spin it? And could you give us maybe an example?
Yeah, sure. So the article was, the basic foundation research was on today's fathers, modern day fathers.
Interesting.
And, yeah, a lot of people were doing articles on the moms and what it is to be a mom. And I was like, well, I'm going to take a different approach. What is it like to be a dad? And what does it mean to be a dad in today's world?
Awesome.
And so I spun one article for New Woman India, which is the English leading new magazine there. And that required a different set of tactics because I'd lived in India, so I understood the audience there, the target audience I was looking at, and the issues they've been dealing with. With the same body of research, I spun an article for Singapore Women's Weekly, and that was a more leisure women's magazine. And so the same body of research, but it required addressing women at a different level. And then I was, I also spun an article for Motherhood, which is again a Singapore-based magazine, but it was more geared toward motherhood, parenting. And so I used the same body of research again, and it was more specific, you know, in terms of the everyday do's and don'ts, because your audience is more on the young mom side.
Okay. I understand. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's excellent. So back to the novels, though. Why is it important for you to write about women?
Oh, dear. That's a real tough one. I still ask myself that. You know, writing the third book, I'm in the third book, and I'm like, why am I doing this again? And, you know, why am I always writing about women? And what is it? And so when I go back to the experiences I had as a journalist, you know, after the interview was over, and this was majority were face-to-face interviews. We didn't have the technology back in the 90s that we have now. You know, I'd put my recorder away and just sit down with the person I was interviewing. And it was usually a one-on-one chat session we'd have. And people, my candidates or interviewees just started opening up to me. They would automatically start talking about issues in their lives, concerns they had, things they were dealing with. And this wasn't just one. This was, you know, one interview after another after another. And all these stories just started festering inside me, I would say, just lying dormant. And having lived, you know, in Hong Kong and grown up in a very, very multicultural setting, and yet we would go back to India for the summers, I would kind of see the issues that my parents were dealing with in terms of extended family, immediate family, relatives of families, friends and friends of family. And I think it became like a spider's web in my head, which just started growing and growing. And everything just started connecting. And what I saw, and, you know, we traveled to so many different countries and, you know, lived. And I saw that the more things change, the more they're actually the same. And women worldwide are connected by universal issues, no matter where you go and how forward you move in time.
Yes, I totally agree. We are so connected, and there's just something about women all over the planet. And, you know, the standard stereotypes, of course, of women being more relationship oriented or more community oriented and taking care of the family, and men being more focused. And I don't know, obviously I don't want to get into the stereotypes because they don't apply individually, but as a unit, women do, that connectivity is so important. And that truthful sort of heart to heart talk that we give to each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it transcends, you know, from generation to generation. It's not like it's washed away or forgotten, because I think there's an emotional IQ level that women just inherently have or are born with. And, you know, things just automatically pass down to the extent that there's an emotional understanding in women, I would say all women, that things don't have to be written and said, but they're just understood.
Good point. We understand with our hearts.
That's right.
And of course, men can do this as well. And it's, we all have male and female aspects to ourselves. But that's the beauty of the duality of the human species, of the women honing that heart-based connection, and the men holding the receptacle of the logic for the women to be creative. It's a yin-yang, obviously.
Somewhere along the lines. Yeah, it is.
Awesome. So what now are you working on? Could you tell us a little bit about your Winds of Fire?
Yeah, Winds of Fire. So again, where did that name come from? It took, you know, a good look into the books that I was writing. And then I found out that really the stories I'm writing, each woman has a fire burning inside. And I never decide where the story goes. It's wherever the wind blows and the character goes with the wind. That's where her story leads me.
Oh my goodness. Isn't that difficult as a writer?
Yeah. I've talked to several media publications, and, you know, they've asked me the same question, and I've really had to think this through. So that's what I've come to understand and accept. That, you know, we all deal with our own battles. Some have to deal with wars. And you just cannot always control everything every time. There are some things beyond your control, and you just have to follow.
Well, that's very true. Being in the present moment and allowing you to walk that labyrinthine path through your story is very special.
It is. It's a different feel, yeah.
So what are you highlighting in your books? And I, you know, don't certainly give away too much if you don't want to. But you just said that each woman has a fire burning within her. So what kinds of fires have you seen burning within women?
I would say, you know, what struck me in, this is the first two books, which is currently with my agent. It's a series that I'm working on. So the first two books deal with emotional abuse. The second book deals with emotional abuse becoming physical. You know, to what extent does a woman need to, or should she continue to sacrifice herself and her self-interests for the sake of the family, duty, honor, and all that other stuff? And when does she finally say enough is enough? What does it take to make her realize that enough is enough? So that's what I really explore in the first two books. In the current manuscript I'm working on, it's the complete opposite, where it's a huge multicultural shift of a woman who's being forced to relocate from her country of comfort to another country of discomfort. And she does this based on, well, what's good for the family must be good for me because I have no choice in this. And so she goes ahead. And then she comes to a new country and she loses her identity altogether. And she has to find herself from scratch all over again and rebuild her life in the best way she can.
Wow. Powerful themes you're exploring. Those are so universal, all three of those. And so much, particularly today, with the way that not only do we travel around the world, but then the way many, many families are being displaced through wars and tragedies in various countries. So that is, those are great universal themes.
Yeah, and it's really hard because, you know, you really, in situations like this, you have to find yourself all over again. And you come back to the question, well, who am I really? What am I?
That's true. That's true. I've often thought when I've traveled around the world, going into a home and staying with friends and being there with people of a different culture, I've thought, what if I lived here full time? And it's an interesting question to explore, to say, what would have to change? What would I have to get used to or revamp or not be that I am right now and pick up and choose to be something else?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. That's true. And the other question, of course, that comes out of that is how much would I be willing to change to adapt to the situation I'm in?
Boy, that's a huge question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great one to consider because most of us don't like change.
No.
And we're very comfortable with where we are. And even, you know, New Year's resolutions and wanting to change basic habits is difficult sometimes. That's not being forced on us by a different culture, a different part of the world. Yeah. So how did you, I'll get back to your personal story for a minute, because obviously your characters are reflecting what you've lived yourself. How did you, when you've lived in various parts of the world, adapt to these different cultures?
Oh gosh, it's like you start all over again. And, you know, as a mom and a wife, you know, I've got two kids. They're grown up now, 19 and 15. But at the time when we were moving around, it was getting them settled into new schools, getting them settled and, you know, into the new location, place we were in. And that took a while because you've got to get your bearings again of where am I? Where's the closest grocery store? Where's the laundromat? Where's the park mm-hmm. to take the kids? And it's just getting your geographical bearings all over again. That's the external side. But then the internal side is looking at yourself and saying, okay, so what do I do next? You know, how do I move forward with this? And how do I adjust to all the changes? And does that make me any more of a person or any less of a person? Because now I've got to do all these additional things, but I gave up all of these previous things.
Interesting. Was there a theme that you carried through from one country or one location to the next?
In terms of the books or in terms of the personal journey?
In the personal journey. I mean, obviously, if you were a writer in one place and you're still a writer in the next, that's a theme that you can carry. And an identity is a better word maybe than a theme, you know, an identity that you carried from one place to the next.
So I would say that, you know, having grown up in Hong Kong, for example, with 36 nationalities just within our school, and that was just the best experience ever. There was a level of acceptance that you automatically inherit from that kind of a experience, I would say. You accept things very quickly, and you just know how to get about and go forward. You don't judge anybody. You don't have a mindset or a stereotype against anyone mm-hmm. because you're already so open to all the different cultures, traditions, values, belief systems that you're like an open or an empty cup just waiting to fill.
Wow.
And there's never a sense of, well, if it doesn't work for them, it's not going to work for anyone. Or if it doesn't work for me, it's not going to work for anybody else. It's just an open, broad-minded acceptance. So when we moved from one country to another, I actually found that aspect missing. That's what I found was missing, because you move to a new location, you see more of those particular people in that location, obviously, because you're in a different country. And that multicultural aspect, which was there, which I grew up with, was kind of missing. So you saw people not being willing to accept, not being willing to be broad-minded, not being willing to think outside of the box, that there are other possibilities or other ways to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very unified approach.
Interesting way to put that. And you're right. We see that in our own neighborhoods, our own cultures, our own cities, where even moving from one location of a city to another, where there's different ethnicities, different cultures, that we tend to, as human beings, I'm a biologist and an animal behaviorist, and looking at the way humans act and behave, we put ourselves in boxes many of the times. So get very comfortable with, this is what my neighborhood does, this is what my culture does, and forget to be a tourist, to travel and to experience those other cultures and get comfortable with them.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what advice, okay, so I'm steering away from here for a moment, from writing, sure. mm-hmm. and thinking about your children and thinking about children in general. In some cultures or some faith traditions, children, when they get reach maturity, take off a year and go experience another culture or travel around just to get that experience you were just sharing and not be so stuck in where they are born and raised. Mm-hmm. So what advice, I guess, would you have for young people going forward to start to think outside the box or open their minds to different solutions?
Oh, dear. Advice to young people. That's a tough one. My own kids give me.
If you've got a 15-year-old and a 19-year-old, you must have shelved out a lot of,
Oh, dear. That advice usually comes back at me. Like, really? You thought you were right? I don't know. I guess the best advice that I can give is, you know, take what opportunity you can get. And this is something I constantly tell my kids, which goes in contradiction with what they're taught and they hear from, you know, people outside. And it's very simple. I tell my kids, the world, your world, let's start and say this, your world is not about you. Your world is what you make of the people around you.
Ooh, I like that.
And the way I see it, the more people you can add and the more experiences from others you can add to your life, the more of others' burdens or responsibilities you can take on, even if it's for a short while, for whatever time it is, the more you add to your own experience, and that's when you really grow. Because if you just sit in your little box and it's all about I, me, myself, you're not really going to get very far except kind of just hitting the four corners of your box and coming back.
Right.
But if you step outside and kind of look at what's around you, who's around you, and share those experiences that other people are having, believe me, you'll grow. You'll really grow in phenomenal ways. And so take whatever experience comes your way and just run with it.
Can people get experiences through reading?
Oh, gosh, I travel the world through reading. And I used to think Hong Kong was a boring place after about 20 or so years because you get used to your environment. You know, it becomes your comfort zone. And so when I was reading, I began to explore, and I started reading at an early age. So I was exploring different countries, different lifestyles, different ways of, you know, behaving. But more than that, it was the values and the beliefs that you're introduced to in books. And that kind of works in synchronicity, I would say, when the author takes you to another country. And it all kind of blends in and you really learn. And then, of course, when you're watching something on the media, automatically you know something isn't right because what you're reading may contradict with what you're viewing on TV or hearing through social media.
Good point. So it broadens the mind and opens up the possibilities, and it also brings in the critical thinking for oneself.
Absolutely. I would say that. I mean, that's what's worked for me, so that's what I would say might work for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Would you advocate that people travel?
Yeah, like I would say, if, you know, experience comes your way, and if it's a safe country to travel in, and it seems like, you know, it's a good place to be in. You know, look into all the factors you need to when considering your travel episode ahead and go for it, because the more you expose yourself, the more you're bound to learn and grow. And it also depends on, you know, what are your goals in the travel? You have to ask yourself, what are you looking for to gain? What experience do you need to, because you may have 2-3 conflicting opportunities. So then you've got a question, which is the right one for me now?
That's a very good point. Travel can be for many different goals and many different experiences, but it's not necessarily, oh, how can I put it? I'm thinking of when people go on spring break, they can either go for beaches and drinking, or they can go to actually maybe learning about the wildlife or the nature aspect, or they can learn about the cultures or do a service project, or, you know, there's multiple choices now.
Yeah,
obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, again, you just have to really think through, what do I want right now?
Wow, fantastic. Okay. Right. So I want to get a little bit into peace. How have you possibly explored peace in your stories? And something that comes to mind, I'll just throw out there, are obviously the themes you are talking about, the life experiences of emotional and physical abuse, and then changing identity those are all about self-peace, if you will. So I know that really you are exploring it. And that way, I'll just throw that out there. But let me let you answer that question.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think the first thing that I really had to understand is that for anyone, and, you know, my characters to me are as real as the person who I'm dealing with or talking to. You know, they're as real as you are,
yes.
Gail.
yes.
So believe me, they're all fictional. They don't exist, but to me, they're as real as you are. So when I look at their aspect of peace, what I have to understand is the definition of peace for me comes with a sense of inner contentment. It comes through acceptance. When you accept the situation you're in or the problems you have at hand, the next step obviously is, okay, so I need to do something about it. Because if you don't do anything about it, you're not at peace. There is no contentment. So obviously you've got to solve that problem. And this is beautifully said, you know, by Eckhart Tolle, the author of The Power of Now.
Yes.
It's a fantastic book. I read it over a period of a month. It took me that long to read it. And I look to reading it again. And so again, it's important because if you can live with yourself to begin with, that's when you can live with others. If you're not happy with yourself, no matter how happy the environment is around you, you're still going to be miserable.
Very wise words.
That just comes from observation, from, again, personal experience. You know, a bright, beautiful, sunny day may be hot and scorching if you're as miserable as can be.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yes.
But if you've had a great day, then that bright, beautiful day just suddenly becomes 10 times more, great than it already is. And so the way I explored that in my stories, again, is where the characters take me. So in the first and second book, you know, I have to question, well, my character questions, how is she going to find peace considering she's weighing the options between duty to family and a loveless marriage? Then, of course, there's a complication of a child that comes in this loveless marriage. Then, of course, the parents, her own parents, trusting members of the extended family over her. Each time, it's a new obstacle that she has to deal with. And with each new obstacle, there's her sense of inner peace is thrown out of balance. And she's got to find that again and again and again. And, of course, each obstacle becomes harder and harder. But when she just kind of manages to get over each hurdle, she comes to a sense of equilibrium again until the next thing kicks in. So that's how I explored it in my stories. And, you know, the final frontier comes in when she has to stand up for herself and what she believes in. And the trigger for that standing up comes from her children, her child, I would say. Obviously, it means she's got to take on, you know, step out of her comfort zone, take on the new challenges, take the bull by the horn, so to speak, because she's not just standing up for herself now, she's standing up for her son.
Yes.
When she gets to a point that she can accept that, that's when she can take on that challenge. It's the same with the current manuscript I'm working on. She's dealing with all these issues where she starts off as a negative. She has never seen herself in the light that she sees herself at the opening of the story. And that kind of makes her realize, oh my gosh, is this who I really am? And what about who I thought I was for all these years? So she has to see herself in a new perspective, a new light. And then, of course, the next thing is she's got to do something about it. Until she does something about it, she can ignore it. Ignorance is bliss, and that's working.
It's for many of us, I'm sure.
Well, for myself too, you know, ignorance is bliss. As long as you can kind of forget, you have to deal with it. It's like, yeah, never mind. We'll deal with it next time. Mm-hmm. But when she comes to a point at the beginning that she realizes, oh gosh, is this who I really am? And she's actually appalled at herself. That's when she has to do something. As the story progresses and that forward movement continues and kind of snowballs, she begins to see a new perspective or a dimension of herself, which she never, ever knew existed within her. And it all comes from within. You know, the external factors are all the triggers, so to speak.
Right. It sounds like you've really thought this character out, or she has blossomed in front of you and really been multi-dimensional, very lifelike, as you just said. It sounds like real life, which is fantastic.
Well, let me tell you how all my characters come to me in my dreams. So the current manuscript I'm working on, let me just tell you, she came to me in my dream as a nightmare, holding holding my vacuum cleaner in her hand. And I just looked at her and I was like, what are you doing with my vacuum cleaner? And why? And, you know, she had no words. All I could see were tears streaming down her eyes. And this expression on her face, which just made my heart ache for her. And that's when I knew something was seriously wrong. Because I knew she was holding onto that vacuum cleaner for a reason. I just didn't know what. And that's where I had to start exploring. Who is she? Where is she from? What's going on? Why is she stuck with this vacuum cleaner? What does it mean? You know?
Yes.
And that's how my stories begin. I get them through dreams, and I have to work backwards like a detective to figure out the answers.
What an interesting way to get your inspiration. And
yeah,
I'm sure
nightmares. Nightmares, so to speak.
Oh, my. It says to me we ought to write more about our dreams, or certainly pay attention to them, and lots of inspiration coming through them. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're having me be a little speechless here, because I'm I'm thinking of the complexity that you're writing about. That's so important, because life is complex. And when we are wanting to find that peace or that equilibrium, as you said, once we cross a hurdle or we overcome an obstacle, finding that equilibrium is so important, because that's where we can each get to the space, the breath, if you will, to say, okay, what's next? And then to ask the important question, who am I, and receive an answer in the moment. And it feels like your writing really has that depth to it, where you're following the character arc and the hero's journey, where it really comes to that place of your character beginning to know who she truly is. And that, of course, helps the reader learn who each of they truly are as well.
I mean, I would definitely say that, you know, it's not something I go in expecting. I just go in with the hope that I'll be able to write the story from start to finish. And, you know, that's good enough as a first draft.
Yes.
But, you know, at a book club discussion I had when my first book came out, it was amazing to hear how different readers from different countries had all read this one book, and all of them could identify with it. And there was a gentleman in the book club discussion who said, why are there no men in this meeting? There should be more than just two or three men here.
Yes.
And I didn't realize that, you know, this was something, or these were themes that men were connecting to at their level.
Interesting. So why were there not more men in that room?
Because I guess, you know, it's just something that appealed more to women. I know men definitely read more nonfiction than fiction. I know that for sure. And, you know, maybe it's something that will just come around when it takes its time. You know, books have a way of evolving, and maybe it's something that'll come up in its own time. But just knowing that your readers can take from that experience more than you expected and look into the details more than you even thought they would, it's a real eye-opener.
It is, and readers do follow the details so particularly, so strongly, that as a writer, that must be a little daunting to be able to keep all the details straight and put together in a way that readers can follow them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would sit and rewrite and think to myself, are these details as important? And to me, obviously, the answer is yes. You know, I've got to know the details. And I thought, well, you know, if the readers are not that detail-oriented, that's fine. At least I know for my self-satisfaction that I've done the job right. But when your readers come back at you and they've noticed those details and they ask you about it, that just takes, you know, for me, it's a personal journey. It kind of goes to a whole new level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting. Will there be sequels of the sequel?
Yes. In this series alone, I have already seen, I can tell you there are about 7 to 8 books.
Oh, my goodness. That's
that
fantastic.
I mean, those are ones that I can see. And then, you know, then I know there are two huge series on the back burner. Mm. And I've already seen them visually, so to speak. And the question for me is that a series? Is it a one-off book? And if so, does it tie into the series, or is it a series by itself? And again, there are huge, dramatic pivot turning points, whatever you want to call it, that I saw and I visualized and seen it. So it's, you know, getting to grips with this series first, because the series alone just starts in one country and moves across to another. So it moves from continent to continent.
Do we as a reader follow one character or one family, or do your characters simply change but the themes interlink in The Winds of Fire?
It starts with one character to begin with in the first two books, and then the current manuscript is another character altogether. She has her own story, and in future books, the two characters will eventually merge and meet in another book.
Okay, exactly. That makes sense. Your readers can look forward to that. I can tell.
I hope so.
Yes, absolutely. So I want to ask you a little bit about the, I was going to say mechanics of writing. That's not really what I'm after. It's more about advice, if you will, for writers coming up today.
Oh, gosh, advice. I'd say, you know, as a writer, you have to, if writing is of paramount importance to you, then for me, I would say writing is breathing. If I'm not writing for a day, or I haven't been able to think about writing for a day, I'm not able to breathe. That's different for every writer and, you know, every type of writing, so to speak. But what I would definitely say is you've got to be able to put the words on paper or on the laptop or computer, whatever it is you're using, to get it down. You know, just building up those ideas and keeping it stored in your on the back burner in your brain, it's good as a starting point. But if you really want to take up writing seriously, you've got to put it down.
Yes, it has to come out of the head and onto the paper.
It does,
where others can share it.
Yeah, and you may not be in a position to share it with everybody right now, but at least you're getting the words out. And as you let some of the words go, more will come up. And it's like a never-ending stream or river, so to speak. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And you'll kind of learn eventually what writing or what you prefer more over other. You know, what genre, do you have a specific genre you like? Do you like to write poems? Even within poetry, is there something specific that you really love? And in the fiction, even within, you know, the genres of fiction, there are so many subgenres now. Is there anything which appeals more to you than compared to something else? And you start finding yourself in that process.
And so one finds those genres simply by allowing, it feels like from what you've shared, the characters and the stories come to you and you write the story and then that fits into a particular genre, or you mold it to be in a particular genre, or how have you worked that?
Well, here's the best part. You know, I thought I was a romance writer, but then I realized none of my stories have a happily ever after ending. And even within romance, the subgenres have just, you know, spawned. There are so many subgenres now. But my books don't fit into any genre. And I know
so
this sounds...
You created your own?
I don't know what it is. I mean, my agent has kind of looked at the books and, you know, he just loves them to pieces, which is wonderful. But they don't fit anywhere because I've been pulling books out, you know, ever since we had all the bookstores, and I would try and see where it fits in. And it doesn't quite fit anywhere except, I would say, as stands on its own, a standalone.
So you just said that genres have, or for example, the romance writers have all these subgenres. Do you think we need to abandon genres, if you will, at this point and make them all standalone, or... Do you think there is a value in having specific major labels, if you will?
I think genres are good for readers because it helps them find the books they're looking for.
Okay.
So it's more of a shelving term that I would say. It helps readers find you. It helps readers find the books they're looking for. But when you know you're writing something which is off the market or doesn't fit on a shelf, so to speak, or has its own uniqueness, I don't think that as a writer you should ever try to taper your story to fit the market, because that market is going to change no matter what you do.
It's always dynamic, is what you're saying. Yes.
It's always dynamic. It's always going to change in the same way that world events change, in the same way that people move from, you know, country to country and travel. But what you've got to be able to do is to write the best story you can in the best way you know how. And the way I define writing is, you know, it's an art which is perfected by craft. So arm yourself with the tools, get in touch with other writers, network with them to shape your story to the best that it can be. And then understand, what is your story about? What is it trying to tell you? Or what is it trying to tell the reader? And you'll kind of start navigating your story. The more revisions and rewrites you'll do, the more you'll understand the story. How many layers of depth do you have? How many conflict issues are you dealing with? How big is the story world? How narrow is it? And when I say big, I don't mean geographical big. I mean in terms of the layers of story world you have. The more answers you get, the more you'll know where your story is gravitating toward. And you'll understand yourself better as a result.
And obviously, I would imagine, be able to write the story much more easily because you're actually living it in your head.
Well, it actually gets more difficult.
Oh, okay.
which is the mark of, you know, you as a writer growing, which I've learned from other authors and, you know, New York Times and USA Today bestselling authors who took me under their wing and said, you know, it's great that you've got these books done, but the next one should get harder.
Oh, what wonderful encouraging words.
And I asked them why, and they're like, well, that means you're pushing the envelope, which means you're pushing yourself out of that little square box which you were thinking in. Remember I talked about going around and beating yourself up against the four corners?
Yes.
So now as a writer, you're pushing yourself out of those four corners and taking the risk and the challenge of addressing issues you hadn't tackled before.
And getting braver and more courageous as you go forward.
Yes, exactly. And it's hard. It's, you know, the best way I can describe writing is in two words. Well, three words. Very hard work.
Oh, dear. Okay. That's encouragement for all of us writers out there.
but here's the best part to it. It all becomes worth it, really, tenfold, when you see yourself grow as a writer and you see the work that you have produced. It's equivalent to having a baby, I would say.
Yes. And I would imagine also learn or see the effect that your books actually have on the readers, on the audience.
Absolutely. I mean, and I can't even explain, you know, before even my book was released, my debut novel, and I was on Facebook, somebody friended me, and this is, and like I said, it's prior to the book being released, she read the synopsis on the website and she said, this is my story. And and I was like, oh, no, it's a fiction story. She said, no, this is my story because this is happening to me right now.
Wow.
And she was someone on the other side of the world.
What a great affirmation and validation for your story.
Yeah, and it can be really frightening too, because at the same time she wanted to know how the story ended, and when I asked her why, she said, because I want to know if this is how my life is going to move forward.
Wow. Yes.
So when you get to that stage, you kind of realize the power that fiction has, because is it fiction a mirror to fact, or is fact a mirror to fiction?
A little both, I would imagine. And certainly, well, synergistic in the fact that, yes, the fiction always, well, I shouldn't say always, but because we're human beings writing it, it probably does always reflect what's going on in the world at some place and time.
And it goes back to that beautiful quote you said at the beginning, you know, which I absolutely loved, which is about, you know, you're a tourist and you're in that place for a short while and then you have to move on. And you cannot write about something if you have not lived it. So sometimes you live it personally, sometimes you live it through other people, secondhand. And it's just, it's very empowering.
Well, and that goes back to your quote of, your world is what you make of the people around you. And because the more we have people around us of different, of diversity and of different values and different mindsets, then we actually can start to live in their worlds as well and broaden our whole scope.
Absolutely. It works both ways.
Yes, it does. So we have just a few more minutes left with the interview with you before going into the Peace Brain meditation. And do you have any other words for our listeners? And when are we going to be able to read your three books in this series?
Oh, gosh. Well, you're making me more excited than I am. I'm hoping, the first two books are currently with my agent, which is really exciting. So let's see what good news he has to share with us. The third is still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And I know the story, I know where it's heading, but it's a question of, you know, getting it down and really, really fleshing it out. And, you know, when we have some good news back from my agent, that's when I'll be able to share it with all of you.
Awesome.
So that's something to look forward to in the future.
Yes. Yes, we definitely do. We are now chomping at the bit to learn about your characters and their diverse life in various countries. Any other words of wisdom before we sign off with you?
I'm not sure about the wisdom aspect, because I get questioned about that at home quite a bit. What I would say in terms of the words that I could share with, you know, readers and listeners is always open yourself up to experiences that are heading your way. Always be an empty cup, but, you know, without inhibitions and without restrictions, because your world is as big as you allow it to be. The more people, the more experiences, the more diversity you include, the more you learn, the more you grow. And if you're a writer out there, I think the best thing I can say is put the words down on paper. Don't restrict them. If you don't want to share them with anybody, that's fine. You can keep them to yourself. But if it's a part of you, you do have to unleash it and grow.
Excellent. Oh, my goodness. Well, I love your multicultural aspect of what you write about, Anju, and your women's fiction in particular, which, as you're pointing out, is not really fiction, unfortunately, in the world, but certainly lessons and beauty that the readers can learn from all of your novels. So thank you so much for being on the Peace Brain Show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So now, let's all just take a breath. I love the thinking about the multicultural aspect of our humanity, because the world is not, it is one place, and yet it's not just one place. It's made up of this beautiful diversity of cultures, of colors, of foods, of faith traditions and celebrations. And we are the same all over the planet in that we're all one humanity. We want the same things for our families. We want food, of course, and shelter and security. But we also want to be creative and express ourselves. And we all want peace. So it's in different ways, though, that we find those answers and we explore our creativity as human beings. And I'm so delighted to have authors such as Anju Gattani here on the show to explore those different ways that characters and ultimately ourselves can learn about the diversity of the human race and learn about this beautiful world that is much like flowers in a garden, where there are different sizes and shapes and colors and smells, and yet the beauty comes from that diversity. So let's take a breath and go into that Peace Brain meditation. And I invite you to close your eyes if you choose. And I want you to think about your life and your experiences and where you have been in your life, and not just places or people, but experiences you've had. And they could be something as simple as sitting on a bank of a river fishing with your grandfather, or riding in those teacup little amusement park rides with your sister or with your father or mother, or riding on a horse in the forest, or sitting at a computer writing your own story that comes in your dreams. So reflect on your life and the beauty of it, the diversity of it, and your experiences. And I invite you perhaps to create a timeline in front of you from your birth to whatever age you are now. And just visualize in your mind what highlights, what lights up for you on that timeline that are really key experiences for you in your life? Something that really has helped you grow as a person, as a human being, that has given you information about who you really are and what you are to be here on the planet. Or maybe you didn't get all of that, but something that is really important. And just take a look at some of those experiences. Go into one of those pictures, if you will, if you can remember at that age, and think about it. Oh, yes, that happened. And this is what really shaped my life then. Perhaps you moved from one city to the next, or changed schools, or acquired a new friend, or learned a new language, or got a puppy dog, or had a baby or brother or sister born to you, to your family. Whatever it might be, your first job, your first love, or maybe the job you have now is creating that beautiful growth for yourself. Honor and appreciate these wonderful experiences that you have had in your life. And take a breath. And see where you have achieved your equilibrium, your peace, in between experiences, in between obstacles and hurdles that you may have had to scale and to overcome. And honor that you have overcome them. The ones that are in the past, where you have taken a breath and found that equilibrium. And you may be currently in a hurdle or a trial right now in your life. And that's okay. Just be in it and experience it. Because you are finding and growing within yourself those qualities where you can then transcend it and overcome it to find that breath and that pause, that equilibrium on the other side. And as was pointed out today, that reading can often offer glimpses of solutions of how to overcome those hurdles, those sufferings, those trials. So I encourage you to read. Now take a last look at your life in this moment and really put a smile on your face, because this has been your life. You have created it. You have lived it. You have overcome it. You have grown from it, and you are enjoying it. Really savor this journey. Savor who you are. And if there are things you wish to change about yourself, put those forward in your timeline and begin to achieve them. Begin to set the goals to conquer them, to bring those qualities and experiences actually into your life. And take a breath. And with that, you can dissolve the timeline and bring that joy into your heart for being alive at this amazing time on the planet, in whatever country and culture you are living in at the moment. And I thank you for tuning in today to the Peace Brain Show. Open your eyes and come back to the room with a smile. And again, thank you for tuning in and with my guest, Anju Gattani. And you can find out more about Anju at anjugattani.com, A-M-A-N-J-U-G-A-T-T-A-N-I, anjugattani.com. And if you want to connect with me, Dr. Gail Lash, for either my Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions or for us to conduct a peace master plan for your company or organization to become known as a place of peace, please go to our website, tourismforpeace.com, or email me at hello@peacebrain.org. So now, please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your map on the World Peace Trails map. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.